But all this is, you know, we edit all this stuff.
Oh, you do? I thought it was live at 11.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. I put it on my Twitter because I have a Twitter
account. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I should delete it because I was, like, really nervous. I was like, oh, my God, if I say something that's, like...
No. Oh, no, I wish. That would be really cool,
no,
but no,
that's part of the fun.
No, I mean, yeah, say whatever. I mean...
I went through half of one of these attributing an opera to the wrong composer.
Oh, perfect.
Was it La Juive?
La Juive, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And I was going...
I was on it.
Joe lets me go for half, and then he says, I didn't think you mean...
I didn't know, should I or shouldn't I?
Well, of course. No. It's fine.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
It's okay.
Good morning, everyone. We're here recording the 10th episode of the Big COC podcast at the COC headquarters in Toronto. And I have a wonderful panel with me this morning. We've got some juicy topics that we're going to discuss. Returning is Wayne Gooding, who's the editor of Opera Canada magazine. And he's, as I said many times before, on our COC Speakers Bureau doing talks before the operas. He's giving a talk this coming Friday. We'll put a plug in for it now. Next Friday.
Thursday.
Oh, Thursday, right. At the North York Library, Central Library, on Zalame, because that's one of our upcoming productions. And I'm also welcoming back Joseph So, who's a professor emeritus at Trent University. And he now writes for a myriad of publications on opera, Opera Canada, La Scena Musicale, where he has a blog, and also for the British Opera magazine. And I'm really happy to welcome for the first time Aliyah Rosenstock, who's an associate artist manager with Dean Artist Management. It's an artist management based in Toronto and New York, and it represents certainly some of Canada's finest singers. She's also on Opera Canada's board of directors, I found out, so you guys know each other, so
that's
good morning.
A lot of time to you.
So welcome to all of you. And my name is Gianmarco Segato. I'm the adult programs manager here at the COC. Now, our main topic today is going to be a story that broke last week, March 13th, and it was sort of in all the major British papers, and now all the opera blogs have picked up on it. And it's a statement that Antonio Papano made at the, now he's the music director of the Royal Opera Covent Garden, and they were announcing their new 2013-14 season last week. And he made a statement, I'm just gonna read a little portion of it. I can't obviously go through the whole thing here, but the sort of more controversial statement that he made. And I quote, he said, people were complaining about the spate of cancellations that happened recently at Royal Opera, especially around the production of the Meyerbeer Opera, the Robert de Le Diable, which we actually discussed in an earlier podcast. So obviously some reporter sort of said something about that. And with reference to cancellations, he said, it happens more and more. There's something about this generation of singers that they are weaker in their bodies or don't care. I don't know what it is, but it's something that is very, very frustrating for me personally. Now, in the opera world, it's kind of really unusual for somebody, I would say, at his level, at a company like Covent Garden, which is, you know, one of the top companies in the world, to make a statement like this to the press. And when I first read the story, I thought, oh, this is going to stir up some trouble. And indeed, it's been fascinating to watch, and especially on a blog called Slip Disc by Norman Lebrecht, who really does like to stir things up. I mean, he's kind of a troublemaker, but in a good way. It's interesting. But the comments on his blog have been quite something. So you've got singers like Susan Graham, Rosalind Plowright, Christine Gerke, Lauren Flanagan. Just this morning, Dolores Zajic chimed in. Also, Fabio Luisi, who's the Met's principal conductor, have chimed in with all sorts of opinions on this controversial statement. So I thought what we'd do this morning is get our panel's ideas on Papano's statement, and maybe some comments on some of the comments that have come out of it. I'll shut up in just a second, but when it first came out, what I thought was no one's going to respond to this because no singer is going to want to imperil their career. And the surprising thing is that a lot of major singers have come out and spoken about this issue for and against Papano's statement. And I should also say that, you know, this might be slightly out of context, the quote I read. I mean, there's more to it than this. But the fact that he said it, it's out there.
I'm not sure that all the comments actually relate directly to what Papano said.
No, yeah.
And I think what happened, what's interesting about this, it's kind of like he opened a Pandora's box,
yes.
In which he made a statement which people started responding to, and then really what they were talking about were a whole host of real issues surrounding the opera world, and indeed working in the opera world from the point of view of singers. So I think it was really interesting for that. Another of the heavyweights, if you like, who's weighed in on this recently at Norman LeBrecq's invitation was Sir Peter Jonas, from the former general director of the Bavarian stage opera, an English national opera. He actually refers to it as a non-story, but thinks that the issues that came out of it are real issues that do need to address. So, to be addressed. And so I think, and that's why I think so many name singers have gotten into this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the way he talks about it is, like as if cancellation is new, but it's not new at all. Mm-hmm. Ever since there have been opera singers, there have been cancellations. And I just happen to have a magazine with me, Opera Now, where the cover artist, Montserrat Caballé, was known as the queen of cancellations. It's this issue, by the way, March. And I've gone to see her 10 times and she canceled 8. And yes, and even Roy Thomson Hall, she postponed twice. Mm-hmm. So,
but she was very good when she finally made it.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. So cancellation really is nothing new. Now, as to whether there are more cancellations, I think there are more performances now.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Well, the entire industry is changing. So perhaps all of these issues were just simmering, and this was the tipping point, and now we have these public platforms where we can actually voice concerns in a public space where they will actually be read, versus grumbling to your spouse or your agent or your administrator. Now this is something that we can actually all have a discussion of together. Whether or not it is related to his actual comments is also kind of, I'm not really sure that.
He seems to be coming down particularly hard on singers. And maybe younger singers. Implying that singers don't have, I don't know, the physical strength now. That was kind of an odd.
I think that he really didn't want to say what he really wanted to say, which is, really is the established singers that are canceling a lot, not the really young, still in the process of career building. Because you said that a lot of people responded to his statement, but none of those are known as cancelers. The cancelers are the ones that have not responded.
Yeah, that's true.
I think we're talking, there are cancellations, and then again there are cancellations. I mean, if someone gets sick and cancel, you understand
absolutely.
And there's no problem. But really, what he seemed to be alluding to, and I think what you are too, Joe, is like people who achieve a certain status and then do not feel an absolute obligation to perform if they're contracted to perform. In other words, if they don't feel well that day, or they want to go somewhere else that day, or then they go and do it, and they can get away with it because of their status. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he was really referring to, certainly in the context of that Huguenot, to A-list people who were doing it. And I think for most people, I mean, we've all experienced cancellations, and some of them are terribly disappointing. Because you are maybe going to a production to see one person, or mainly to see one person, and that one person cancels. But
that's the beauty of live theater.
It is.
Because
it's the risk.
Yeah, you might end up seeing the start of someone else's career.
That's exactly right. And I think, I mean, it happened to me just a couple of weeks ago at the Met, where I saw The Parsifal and Katharina Dalyman, the Condrey, cancelled on the day I went. Now, I actually wasn't so bothered by that as I would have been if Jonas Kaufman had cancelled or Rene Papper had cancelled. And she was replaced by a young American singer named Michaela Martens, who I did not know, and she was fantastic. I mean, she's a young singer, and here she was in this very auspicious company, and she really lived up to it as well. So it was a very exciting night. Just for that reason.
One of the things that Susan Graham pointed out, which I thought was really interesting, maybe some of the listeners, I certainly took me a while to understand this, about how opera singers are paid, and they're pretty well in an opera production, paid per performance. So they're technically not paid for the 4 or 5 weeks of rehearsal time ahead of time. They're paid per performance, so if they end up having to cancel a performance, they lose their fee for that performance, from what I understand. Is that more or less correct?
That's correct. I mean, also, you have to take into account the fact that the artist has been by themselves coaching and learning the libretto. So it's months and months and months of preparation.
Right.
So for them to go into a production and then have to cancel a night, it's not just, it is the money, but also it's that entire perhaps past 6 months or even up to a year or who knows how long that you've been coaching something and preparing it, and then it's just, it's gone.
Right.
That opportunity is gone. And nowadays, you know, many houses have reduced the number of performances that they're actually showing. So there are only maybe 4, 5, 8 opportunities to do what you are supposed to be doing. And if you have a cold and it lasts a week, that could knock out the majority of the performances.
Right. And I think Susan Graham's point was that people don't want to cancel because, you know, they're potentially losing a lot of money. And like you say, all these coachings, all this stuff that leads up to singing a role, what we finally see on stage, costs a lot of money. It's a lot of money. Yeah.
Every singer signs, you know, of a contract, I mean, expecting to sing. I can't imagine signing a contract expecting to cancel. So they go into it wanting to sing, and if they don't sing, as you say, they don't get the fee. However, having said that, at a few places like the Met, they do get paid for rehearsals.
Right, right.
Well, there's often a rehearsal fee, and so it might be maybe the amount of one night of performances.
Right.
But that's just the rehearsal period that they're there.
Yeah.
Sometimes these complaints come from the audience, and I actually have some sympathy for that. Like as Wayne was saying about, you know, you go there to want to hear one person and that person cancels and you are terribly disappointed. But there's also another financial issue, because in many European houses, first cast, opening night is more expensive. And so I'm dying to name the opera houses, but I won't.
Oh, come on.
Some have really great cast, and then, you know, quite a few weeks, you know, into the rehearsal period, and maybe like a month or so before opening, they announce that Miss So-and-so has, they can't say indisposed, right? That far ahead of time.
Oh, withdrawn.
Withdrawn. Yeah. Yeah. And then they put in someone really very unknown. And because you pay more for those performances, it's been called a kind of bait and switch. It doesn't happen at the COC. It doesn't happen in most North American houses, except the Met, right? They do have, it is more expensive on opening at the Met, opening night. But whether it's a known singer or an unknown singer.
Yeah,
right.
Well, as Aaliyah says, it's part of the risk of live theater. I mean, you know, you have to go with it. I think that, you know, it's interesting, just to go back to the Pappano thing, as you said, Gianmarco, he actually seemed to be addressing his remarks to younger singers. And a lot of the discussion subsequently to that remark are actually about the problems facing young singers. For example, being pushed into roles too early, either by, you know, attractive invitations from opera houses or by their own agents. And so the discussion is actually quite interesting at that level as well, I think, and it's getting away from cancellations, if you like.
I was wondering if he was referring specifically targeting the young woman they had engaged to cover when their original female lead was pregnant. I mean, so they went out and they found this woman to sing in her place. And then in the last week, they decided she wasn't able to sing the role.
Right.
This is Jennifer Rowley, American soprano. Okay, this is like what you're talking about, how everything's out there in the open. She actually, I don't even know how, I linked to some statement she made on her Facebook page, because I think she's getting so tired of having her name dragged through the mud, because it's coming up again through this. And what she said basically, and I mean, this is her view on what happened, was that she is, you know, a soprano, but not necessarily a super high coloratura, you know, really, really super crazy high notes, but that the company, Covent Garden, wanted that kind of voice for that role, but it was the conductor who who said, no, I want more of a real coloratura. And that was the reason she was switched out.
But Papano...
That's what she said.
Papano said that I hired her.
Yeah. Yeah, but he wasn't the conductor for that performance. Right. No, yeah, for that opera.
So this is actually a case really where it's the company itself that has led to the problem in that very specific case, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's certainly something to be said with singers who are pushed into things too early. But also, we can't forget that a lot of houses, this is an issue. You know, they hire someone and they do hire people in advance, and maybe 3 years down the road, they don't want that particular sound anymore.
Right.
Or... they start working with them and they're just, you know, they think that there's someone better. They have someone maybe in the wings that they've been considering, and mm-hmm. maybe they could make it happen. So the thing about this is that a lot of times I think money is involved, whether or not they've accommodated for a particular star singer. And whether now, if they want to replace them, can they get another star singer in there? Or they probably can't afford to because they've got to buy someone out of a contract. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you don't know what's going on in the background. So a simple press release like this, I mean, like you said, he probably wasn't saying what he really wanted to say or the entire story.
I know. I get that gut feeling that he's referring specifically to a few people. Mm-hmm. And if you go back and look at the last 5-10 years, who cancelled at Common Garden?
Right.
It's very obvious who these people are.
They shall remain nameless for now. Some of the other things that in the comments to these stories that came up were things like that we've kind of referred to it a bit, like the economic situation has changed so much in the last few years. So it's kind of being postulated that one of the reasons maybe why certain singers take on roles that aren't quite right for them is that there is less work, and that singers feel pressure to take on roles that maybe aren't perfect for them, but they're like, well, I need the job. I don't know. Does anyone here see any evidence of that? Or
fees are also down. Mm-hmm. So maybe you were able to only do 4 shows a year, but now you have to make it 6 or 7 just so that you can budget for yourself. Mm-hmm. Everyone has to change their budget around because of that.
Mm-hmm. Or they change their repertoire to an area where there's less competition. Like Mozart singers going into Wagner.
Right.
You know, you see that all the time.
Well, it's certainly an interesting topic that continues to attract interest on all these blogs. So go to Slipdisc. It's probably the best one. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff there.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
I mean, the idea that, young singers are pushed too much so they can't, they ruin their voices and so on. You know, but you look at someone like Placido Domingo. Everybody said that, he's going to kill his voice singing Otello. He's still here.
Yes, and his father lost his voice. Apparently, the legend is that his father lost his voice because he sang with a cold. He was singing in zarzuelas, that's what his parents did. And he learned at a young age that you cannot abuse your voice. So all the choices he made, I feel, he knew himself. He thought to himself, I can handle this. Yes. And he was obviously right, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He also canceled quite a bit. He would often sing the telecast.
Well, actually, but it's kind of one more sort of mini topic on this. One thing that seems to keep coming up in the comments is that, yes, young singers are being pushed too early. But then there's this sort of opposite camp that says we're not being given enough time to learn roles, and that we're being forced to, you know, sing roles when we're in our early 20s, when we really should be, you know, waiting till we're 30. And there's this kind of double-edged sword where, I mean, you're reading some comments that, you know, people need to kind of get on with things early, and then, no, you should wait. But if you wait, things are over. I find that kind of true. I don't know. I mean,
do you think it's the nature of the business? Because now, in competitions, you cannot be older than 33 to enter a competition.
Yeah, right. or 30 now, I think. Yeah.
And
most.
You look at young artist programs, they would prefer to pick someone who's 22 instead of 32.
Yeah,
that's correct, yes.
No, that's true.
So there is, I mean, we see that a lot. We have a lot of young artists. And there is, you know, so if you look at an artist's path today, at least in North America, generally, the artist will go to an undergraduate program and maybe they will study for a year, or maybe they'll go into a master's program. And then from that, they'll try and get into a young artist program. By the time they're out of all of this, They are 26, maybe. So then there's this gap. Yes, you can go into competitions, but if you're still developing as a singer and you're still developing your roles, the roles that you feel comfortable in and your voice is right for at that time, there is this, you know, 6-year kind of nebulous time right. where people are trying to find their path. They're sort of grasping at, well, should I be going in this direction or that direction? And that's what, I mean, if you have a manager, that's what the manager should be helping the artist with, figuring out what competitions or what smaller roles they can be taking on, or maybe a role that they're studying but in a smaller house, so they're not trying to scream over an orchestra with 3,000 seats. Mm-hmm. You know, something that's thoughtful. You have to think through what step you're taking before you do it. You can't just throw yourself out there.
Well, it's very hard for younger singers, though, isn't it? Because in the end, the buck stops with them in terms of the decision making.
That's
for all
true.
The fact that it's you have a manager and you're working with a company and so on, which hopefully has your interests at heart too.
Right.
But you're the only one who can say no, or in the end, and it's very hard for economic reasons and for reasons of pride, even almost. I mean, if you're offered something that's really juicy somewhere, maybe you shouldn't be doing it, then you know, it's the temptations are huge.
Yes. Or in economics, you know, do you want to take a day job so that you can eat? Mm-hmm. But then that takes away from your time studying and practicing. But that's something interesting that Delora Zajic said, is that previously artists started studying intensely at a younger age, so they had that, they would have had that family support while they were learning really good technique and basic, you know, solfege, stuff like that, to really get them in a place physically to be able to learn, then proceed on to, you know, languages and roles. So maybe we are missing that extra 5 years, I don't know, where people would have had that nurturing environment where they weren't concerned about going out and earning money so they could put a roof over their heads.
Exactly, yeah. That was good, guys. Thank you. We'll go on to the next topic now, because we could probably talk about this one forever, but it might be good to get some variety into this podcast today. Recently, the Metropolitan Opera, we've already alluded to that, had a new production of Parsifal, Wagner's Parsifal. And why we're particularly interested in this here in Toronto is that this production by François Girard is going to be coming to Toronto in a future season, which is all I can say. But I think we've all had a chance now, or at least a few of us have had a chance to see it either in HD on the movie screens. And I know Joseph actually saw it live. Oh, and you saw it. Oh, okay. And did you see it either place?
Yes, I loved it.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm just curious. I mean, I saw it too. I mean, I don't want it to sound like, oh wow, it was so great because it's coming to the COC, but it really was great. It was such a subtle production, I thought, and I do have one little issue, but not to do with the production. But anyway, I don't know.
Wayne and I agree on this, but I find that there is sufficient difference between what you actually see in the theater and what you see on the cinema screen. Some of it is lost on a cinema screen. Okay, you can see close-ups better, but other than that, for example, I noticed that when you are actually in the theater, there are all sorts of projections in Act Two that is so erotic. It's meant to be. I mean, there's no actual breasts or buttocks, but the curves are such that you just simply cannot be mistaken. And the symbolism is so clear. But all of that is gone in the movie house.
Yeah.
Yes.
I actually do agree with you, Joe. We'd had this conversation, I think, some weeks ago before I'd seen it live, and I wasn't quite sure what you were referring to when you were talking about the erotic imagery of the second act, because I didn't quite get that in the cinema.
I don't really remember.
Certainly got it in the theater. Yeah. I mean, you're very clearly, the cave is very clearly related to the female anatomy.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm sorry, the
sentence.
And so, and so that is very, that did not come over at all in the movie, simply because of the close-ups. I mean, it was a totally different experience.
I wonder if that was a kind of censorship. What do you think?
I don't think so, because I think the way the set was done, particularly for that second act with the big pool of blood on the bottom and all of the flower maidens, yeah, it sort of worked at a distance. I mean, you could only get the real sense of it at a distance, but you cannot film something and just use a long shot for the whole time.
Not
cinema.
Even
it just
one
doesn't
though.
Work. Well, they did a couple of times. It was just so fast that, that you didn't really get a sense of or really register what was actually there. But when you're in the cinema, in the theater, it's very obvious to you right from the very beginning. Yeah. But also, you're right, quite apart from Act Two, some of the other projections were much more effective in the theater than on the
cinema. Where were
screen.
The projections? Were they just above?
At the back. At the towards the back. It
in
was like
one,
a, yeah.
Oh, it's incredible. At one, you know, you feel like you're part of the universe. You
yes.
know?
Yeah. No, it's
oh,
very
we saw
grand.
A bit of that.
You,
bit,
you got
yeah.
some sense of it, but it's much more powerful on stage. And the Act Three, actually, most of the projections for Act Three are actually clouds. I mean, most of it, there's not a lot. But actually, when you see it in the theater, it's much more painterly. The whole scenography, Michael Levine's set and the costumes and the projections are much more painterly than they appear on screen. It's a very spare production, and particularly in Act Three, where the Grail Society is really decaying at this point.
Right.
One of the characters says that they're foraging for food at this point to feed themselves. So it's very harsh environment, but it's very beautiful.
Oh,
to
incredible!
Look at. And it's a very smart production as well. Mm-hmm. I think it does. It's not just a Christian view of this. It's a more spiritual view that embraces a lot more religion, a wider variety of religions than we normally see here.
Especially in
Act
One.
Especially in
Act
One.
Buddhist elements.
The Buddhist elements, the Jewish elements. Yes. It's very, very fun.
Yes.
Well, actually, that kind of brings up the one thing that kind of disconcerted me slightly when I was watching it in the movie theater was only that, as you're describing the production, yes, it embraced all sorts of spirituality. And yet, to me, the subtitles were so Christian-centric.
I know.
And it was like, am I reading the Bible here? It was, but it didn't meld at all with what I was seeing on the screen. So those were the Met's subtitles. You know, I don't know what we'll have here eventually.
But it's in the text. That's the problem.
I know.
A lot of it is.
But
simplified in the subtitles. I see what you're saying.
It was
actually.
Kind of like.
It's also very Catholic, actually.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I felt that it wasn't. It softened the message. The fact that the set and what they had them doing on stage, it softened the text.
Yeah.
I didn't feel like I was being, you know,
browbeaten
or something. That there was being shoved at you. You know,
right.
It was just this sort of. It was a beautiful presentation of a story, you know, and then it was a Christian story, but then there were also these other elements to it that you could understand just simply because of the way it was presented to you.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does the misogyny bother any of you in this production? Where the women are all on the other side, there is a crack on the earth separating the two sexes.
Well,
the women didn't get any of the communion.
No.
I didn't understand that, actually.
Well, you know, I mean, there are religions where the women are separated from the men in the act of pursuing the religion. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
It didn't bother me. It is a misogynistic opera, actually. I mean, you can't just get away from that.
It's a brotherhood,
and then there's Kundry, who eventually. I thought one of the most moving things in this was the redemption of Kundry.
Right.
The way they handled that, it was absolutely stunningly
with this
cathartic.
It was
almost cathartic. I've never seen it so effectively done as it was here.
Definitely.
But it didn't bother me. I mean, having them separate, I just thought it accentuated the fact that it was pan-religious, if you think. It was so all-embracing that you recognize that they had veils sometimes.
Completely.
Yes.
You can't see them at all.
But
and
the thing is that most opera is politically incorrect, if I may put that out there.
Yeah.
And you have to suspend most of your, you know, especially as Canadians, we're all very, you know, polite. But I know there are a lot of things that bother me in a lot of operas, but you have to put that aside. You have to think, well, what is the context in which this piece was written?
And
can I appreciate it despite this? And usually, yes, you know, that's the answer. And so it might be misogynistic, but you have to accept that that's what the story is about. You know, they're not going to start including women in this brotherhood, you know.
Yeah.
It's just,
but
maybe they will. I mean, maybe in a new presentation they'll include women. I don't know.
But in this production too, didn't he purposefully at the end have them mix, the genders mixed?
When they were burying
towards
Daniel,
the end,
I think
you saw the women coming.
They did come together. It was after the redemption of Kundry.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. But I mean it's subtle at the end.
It's also subtle,
sort
but
of like you see them going, you can imagine the world going forward and
also she dies too in this production.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, touched by the spirit, you have to die. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because she's a woman. I find that kind of strange.
Yeah.
Does she not normally die, Kunri? Like, but
no.
she just
she
sort
sometimes
of
yeah. Well, she has. I've seen
sometimes,
both actually.
Yeah.
Sometimes she does. She just sort of expires almost.
I mean, she'd been living for eons. That
that's
poor
right.
woman.
I mean,
just, she was
point.
So
she's
tired.
Finally,
she just wanted to sleep.
It worked very well. She is finally released.
Yes.
I mean, she's cursed. Cursed herself
exactly.
actually. Laughter.
Yeah.
He's laughing at Christ.
Do you remember how old she's supposed to be? 1,000 something.
Oh, it's yeah. I mean,
because. Emilia Marti is 300 something, but Kunri is over 1,000.
Even older.
Yeah.
She looked great.
She
looks
good
thought she
though.
Looked great.
Yeah.
But actually, while just to end, while we're because it came up in the news just over the last since we did the last podcast, and while we're on the HD topic, it seems that while season announcements are being made by these big companies, the general directors or the music directors are making somewhat controversial comments. And Peter Gelb, who is the general director of the Met, of course, when they were announcing the new Met season for next year, he remarked, they were talking a bit about, you know, ticket sales have been down and this sort of thing, and he put some of the blame, I thought it was a bit of an odd statement, on what he called the cannibalization of the Met audience by the HD transmissions, meaning that perhaps they're losing some of their audience at the Met, people who would normally go to the theater, so I guess we're talking about people in the New York area who are going instead to the movie theater.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because obviously this HD thing has been a huge thing for the Met
from
a publicity point of view, hopefully now in terms of financially as well. I mean, but there's this other side, and it's just very interesting to me that after so many years of having these transmissions, we're finally getting a bit of more of a sense maybe of what it's really doing to the live audience.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
That's been talked about for some years.
Yeah,
already.
Yeah. But for
he's
him to make that statement.
Well,
you know?
He actually has said this before
in
an interview with the New York Times about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and the people where they're losing them, or where he thinks they're losing them, is from places like Boston. Not too far away
right.
from New York, but far enough that it's a bit of, you know, a hike to get in there, where people are simply deciding that it's easier for them to stay locally and cheaper. To stay in their own home area and go and see do their performances in the cinema. And it is an issue everywhere, actually. And I still think we're waiting for the other shoe to drop here, because I think it's this is something that's coming that is evolving over time. And that he used the press conference to say it again.
Says
it's a real issue.
Yeah.
Opera America, the industry group, is actually doing a major study of this in a couple of Canadian companies and American companies to try and get a sense over time as what over now what has happened over the to their audiences.
I have this dystopian sort of vision of all major opera companies just becoming production houses where they just film themselves and then occasionally there will be a live performance so that everyone can get the, you know, close-up shots and they don't have to spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I'm joking, but maybe that is the way
but
it's
going.
But going
down the road, I mean, it's not just the Met Live in HD anymore. It's like Munich.
Yes.
Royal Opera.
La Scala.
La Scala. They're all getting into this, and some of them are doing Glyndebourne as well.
Yeah.
And some of them are not just going into movie theaters. They're coming to your friendly local computer, which is to your friendly local TV screen, with free live screening.
It's bizarre.
Or with a subscription.
Or with a subscription for something
okay.
like... No. I mean, Munich does have, what, half a dozen broadcasts a year
yes.
that they do live? You can get it on
they
your
have
computer.
I wonder
out.
If that's government funded.
Oh,
that seems
oh I'm
very
sure it
anti,
is, but it's
I mean,
part of outreach
not a smart
for them.
Business.
You know, it's outreach.
Yeah.
Glyndebourne. I mean, I got to see the Jerry Finley Meistersinger because they broadcast it over TV.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the choices available to us as audience members now are just becoming richer every day.
And we're really in the middle of it. That's the thing, you know.
Yes.
Like you say, you don't know where it's all going to end.
It's
you know, I mean, your idea, I've thought that before. But I mean, you know, the money has to come from somewhere. I mean, you know, ticket sales okay only pay a certain portion mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. what it costs to put on opera productions, but it does pay some of it. So no one's going to the theater, I don't know who's
where. Advertisers. Maybe it'll sort of, you know how it was in the beginning on the radio where, you know, brought to you by Texaco or whatever, and now it's going full circle.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm kind of surprised the statement comes from Gail, because they are benefiting from it, from the MedinHD, because they, you know, they mm-hmm. make a profit from that. You know, the problem is the regional houses. They are, the people mm-hmm. are going to the Med in the movies and not going to the local opera company. I know for a fact that in the beginning they just say, come to the Med, come to the Med. And then later they add, come to the Med or to support your local opera company.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was added on as a result of some complaints.
Oh, for mm-hmm. sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look, I know a couple of people who stopped subscribing to live opera.
Wow.
I mean, they're happy to go to, I mean, there are now, what, 11 Met Live in HD a year? I mean, that's 11 operas. That's more operas than most, or any Canadian company, actually. Mm-hmm. And they're perfectly happy with that.
But I mean, there's also playing devil's advocate here. I mean, when I go to these Met broadcasts, half the audience I recognize from the COC audience or Atelier, or, you know, they're all people that love opera and they still want to experience it live. And then you have to also ask yourself about the people that are going to the opera, maybe this is like opera light for them because they get to go to the movies, and you know, I get my chili cheese fries. I irritate my neighbors, but I'm just happy, you know, as heck sitting there eating my cheese fries and watching the Met. I mean, you can't do that. So you know, these are people that don't want that extra added, you know, whatever their feelings are about going to the theater, but they're happy to experience opera, and then they will be attentive to, you know, maybe they'll purchase things on iTunes, their favorite singers, mm-hmm. they'll follow them, and maybe it will convince them to attend a live performance when normally they wouldn't. So
yeah, hopefully.
I would love to see the statistics, you know, how many people actually start going to live opera as a result of the Met, and how many people stop going.
Maybe it evens it out.
Yeah, it'd be nice to, I think that's part of what Opera America is trying to get at, but I don't know that the companies have all been, you know, keeping the right data to actually get to those mm-hmm. to that bottom line just yet. I mean, I'm sure they all are. I mean, the issue, you say, regional companies, I think, and think of them here in Canada. I mean, we're strung out along this border and with huge distances. Mm. And, you know, somewhere like, I think, Manitoba Opera, both its productions this year, it only does two productions. Both of the operas are on the Met roster. I mean, what does that do as well? Mm. I mean, it's not as if the Met is doing on the Live in HD unusual operas that you're not going to likely to see anywhere else. Mm-hmm. They're doing the, you know, the ones that are crowd pleasers as well. So I think the issue, that's why I keep saying the shoe's going to drop here, the other shoe, because it's, we all enjoy it, but mm-hmm. it's not necessarily a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, stay tuned for more developments on that topic without a doubt. Thank you very much, Aaliyah, Joseph, and Wayne for joining me today. It was a great conversation, and we'll no doubt do it again in the not-so-distant future. So please check out these podcasts. You can find them on COC Radio directly on our website. You can also download MP3s from the coc.ca website, or probably the easiest is to subscribe on iTunes, where we are now regularly. We always put these podcasts up on our blog, Parlando, announcing the new podcast, who's appearing, the topics, with links to some of the stories. So if I haven't, you know, gone into great detail of the actual news story, you can link to them from there. And that's a good place also to leave comments and suggestions. So till next time, we'll see you then. Bye-bye.